Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is James Elroy, whose latest book is The Hilliker Curse, My Pursuit of Women, a Memoir. Recent novels include Blood's a Rover, earlier books, L.A. Confidential, The Black Dahlia, nonfiction, My Dark Places, 18 books in all. This latest is a memoir, but it's a specific kind of memoir. It's not quite a memoir of James Elroy, the writer. And it's not a memoir of James Elroy and his relationship with his murdered mother, because we already saw that in My Dark Places. But instead, it's a memoir dealing with his relationships with a variety of women and how that impacted his life. What prompted you to, A, write the memoir, and B, write it in this fashion?
I always moved back to L.A. when my wives divorced me. And I moved back to L.A. in the late summer of 2006. I had been passionately embroiled in the Bay Area with a woman named Joan who dumped my ass, and I had been having a series of dreams about a woman I'd met very briefly in Los Angeles, and she lived there. I figured, what the hell, why not go to L.A.? I didn't want to live in San Francisco, and I moved back to Los Angeles. It had occurred to me after my second marriage to my dear friend Duncan Ode went aground that the dominant storyline, moral line of my life has not been crime in me, my mother's death in me, but women in me. And that's when I conceived this as a shorter form book, a romantic history, and an autobiographical essay, in that I was of an age, pushing 60, where I could describe the literal events of my earlier life and attribute meaning from the perspective of the more mature man. The form fit the intellectual rigor. Having to go back and relive it emotionally was very, very seductive. I could not have predicted the ending, which is that I would meet the woman who would become the love of my life.
Which still is ongoing. I mean, that's
Erica Schickel, who is the dedicatee of the book, she and I continue.
Let's narrow this down a little. You finished Blood's a Rover, and Blood's a Rover was going to come out, because you're in an interregnum now between series, or you finished the previous series. Was there anything that actually triggered the idea of writing this? Was it Joan dumping you, or just moving back to L.A. and saying, well, let me relook at L.A.?
I had elements of the story in my mind for years. I had a crack-up that I describe in agonizing detail in Blood's a Rover. My second marriage to Duncan Ode went in the tank. I needed to take time off from writing fiction. I write TV shows and movies and earn a good living. The book came to me very, very slowly, and it wasn't until Joan first, and then later Karen in Los Angeles, that I began to see these two women as the proactive voices of history. And had I not gone through those two severe ass-kickings, although I did my share of the ass-kicking, I could not have conceived the book in the detail that I did. So it's the story of a young boy with a lost mother who peeps windows, as I used to, who follows people around, who stalks, as I used to, who follows a woman, a leftist revolutionary named Joan Rosen Klein.
That's her real name?
No. Joan's name was Joan, and she was Jewish and had dark gray streaked hair, but that's as far as it goes. It wasn't until those tumultuous, ultimately misaligned relationships that the full book came to me.
And when it came to you, you must have realized that you would have to open yourself up to a kind of self-examination that you may be doing on a daily basis, but to put it in print and have other people see it is something else again, including these women.
There's that. There's the fact that, with the exception of Duncan Ode and Erica Schickel, the women's surnames are omitted. Certain details are omitted. The moral parameters of memoir are as follows. You can't lie. You can't invent dialogue. You can omit. You can emphasize. You can describe yourself as a younger man and attribute meaning to your actions as a more mature man. And that appealed to me. Hence, there's a motif of then and now. and I had never written in the autobiographical essay form before.
You kind of did in My Dark Places.
That was true, but that was a murder story. This was something much shorter and much more in essay form.
I haven't read Blood's a Rover, but I'm going to be looking at this book very differently because the book was written while you were with Joan, and she's a character in the book.
I actually broke up with Joan, but I had conceived Joan Klein, whose name was not Klein, as the proactive voice of revolution at that point. Joan and I represented an interesting disjuncture. We were deeply about dialectic, but there was not a compensating softness and love to carry us through. Left wing, right wing, Jew, Christian, atheist, believer, bisexual, straight. It shouldn't have worked on paper, but boy, oh boy, was it passionate up to a point. And I began to see Joan as the cataclysm of history. And to move from her to Karen down in Los Angeles, a very gifted historian, a college professor, it all exploded in my mind.
When you call her a cataclysm of history, I mean, she's a person. She's not a symbol.
No, she's not. But Blood's a Rover is fiction. And so I was able to take Joan and extrapolate her fictionally and have her do things she didn't do and things she really did, attribute aspects of her personality to Joan Klein, and extrapolate again.
Did you ever hear from her about Blood's a Rover?
I did not.
You did not, so you have no idea.
No.
When I was talking with noir expert Eddie Muller, we were talking about the film version of Black Dahlia. What Eddie said to me is interesting, and it absolutely plays a role in The Hilliker Curse and in all your work. He said what De Palma never got is that James Ellroy's books are all about men being saved by women. And then in The Hilliker Curse, in essence, you are looking for that savior.
Yes, it's a very, very good perception. For Eddie, Eddie comes up with the extraordinary occasional perception. For instance, he does not see Barbara Stanwyck as the baddie in Double Indemnity, the movie. He thinks that Fred McMurray, Walter Neff, has the soul of a terrorist and is just looking for something, a woman, to give him the impetus to kill someone and play the game. And he's utterly correct about that. What's amazing about the ending of this book is that Erica Schickel, who I met in 07, we hooked up in 09, conjured me with greater acuity and persistence than I conjured her, although she was very, very much on my mind. We had it for each other very badly from our April 07 meeting. It just took a while. She was married. She had children. I was out on the loose. I had a girlfriend. At the time, we kept looking for each other at parties, and damned if my publisher didn't make me go on Facebook. And she stiffed me a message. Richard, I did not know how to type in a message on Facebook. A woman who works for me, a colleague, showed me how to hunt and peck.
And she responded, and there you go.
We developed a deal where I could write handwritten faxes to her computer, and it would scan on the screen.
One thing that's kind of a subtext in your relationships with these women and any other women who know you're James Ellroy for any length of time is that they have a pretty good idea of who you are. I mean, they don't know fully, but anyone who reads your books, and I've read most of them, get a pretty good idea. I mean, when I talk to you, and I've talked to you, we've known each other for over 20 years. The James Ellroy I see is the James Ellroy splattered all over the books, even though they're fiction.
Yes.
They had one up on you.
It was an unfair advantage. I met Joan and Karen from the podium. I met Erica in a collegial context. She knew who I was but hadn't read me, and she saw something in me that went far beyond published text, rumors, or reputation. She saw something emotional, and it struck a very deep chord in her, and she struck a similar chord in me.
Do you think that even for you, even though you're not a celebrity like a rock star or a movie star, that there's kind of a fear that they do have you tracked if they've read your books?
No, because literary celebrity is Mickey Mouse compared to the antics of, what, reality show performers, Joey Buttafuoco, and what was the girl that he was popular?
Oh, Fisher?
Amy Fisher, right?
Yeah.
Yes, that right back in Long Island way back when. It's not quite the same thing. Erica is a journalist. Erica is a memoirist. Erica has a book out. Erica has a second book almost out. We're professionals, and it's an entirely different world. And she saw something in me, and I saw something in her. And when I went off to brood about Erica in the dark, we very rarely talked about books.
In terms of writing Hilliker Curse, the style, the format, is the same staccato format of a noir book. So it's almost like it's a romance and tell-all in a way written in the style of a noir.
It is and it isn't. It's fully explicated sentences. I have gone on to a richer, more explicated style in Blood's a Rover, and I followed it up in The Hilliker Curse. But it is written in the language of Hardboiled. I talk about God, religion in one moment, and the next thing you know, I'm using foul language. Yet there are no explicit sexual descriptions in the entire book. It's a decorous book. I err on the side of honor in my depictions of women, and I'm glad that I took that high tone.
It would seem to me that none of these women would be upset at your portrayal. Joan could, but I don't see it either. You take so much responsibility.
I was wrong. I was coming off a nervous breakdown, and you have done this before. You throw yourself at the blank spaces of people, and you're grateful for their momentary capitulation to you, and it keeps you going to next week, right? Right. And there was a lot of smiles from Joan, touching from Joan, that kept me going through to next week. Whereas, if I had had the prescience that Erica Schickel instilled at me, I would have realized, oh, man, I'm getting out now.
We can never know that till after the fact.
No, we cannot.
I mean, that's part of what growth is all about, I guess. Did you feel, when you're finished, that you'd achieved some kind of catharsis, even beyond the fact of meeting Erica?
It was only about meeting Erica. I will feel very, very relieved when I go home day after tomorrow. I do L.A.-based gigs, and I go to Great Britain for a week for the Hilliker Curse. British book tours, Richard, are wonderful because you're in a very civilized foreign country where everyone speaks English and they don't hate Americans. And working-class people will spend their last $24 on a book. I have never met a more egalitarian, a more classless, a more avid readership than I have in Great Britain, and they read our language, and in fact, we got it from them.
Well, why do you think that is?
Print media is wildly powerful in Britain today. They have innumerable newspapers, foldouts, as well as broadsheets. They have state-sponsored cultural radio that puts NPR to shame. They have great classical music, 24 hours. The BBC puts out magazines like Classical Music Monthly. They have a show called Desert Island Discs that debuted in the months after World War II, where writers will come on and talk about or celebs talk about their favorite music. They play the music at some length, and there have only been 3 hosts of Desert Island Discs in 65 years.
Sounds a little like some places of KPFA, but it's both good and bad. I mean,
right.
You know, the new blood is not in, but on the other hand, you have the continuity and the intelligence
right.
the growth. Yeah. You're listening to an interview with James Elroy, whose latest book is The Hilliker Curse. James Elroy, with the material for The Hilliker Curse came an article, an interview that appeared last year in the Paris Review, which to me was kind of eye-opening. You made some amazing comments about your work and about you yourself that I've never seen before. One of the comments that you made, you said, "I'd rather live in a society that errs on the side of authoritarianism than a society that errs on the side of permissiveness."
L.A. is grossly overpopulated. It's impossible to drive down crowded streets at night. It might be nice, and this is, of course, somewhat joking, to thin the herd a little bit in a non-bigoted manner and just have fewer people who treat each other better. And there has been a horrible, horrible breach of the civil contract. I cannot go in to buy a slice of pizza without talking to a kid who's on his or her cell phone and concluding a long conversation, liberally peppered with "it's like" and "I'm like" and whatever, to get my ing piece of pizza and get back out in the sun. That's what I mean by that. It's about an abrogation of the civil contract.
But in America, at least, that abrogation, from what I've seen, stretches all across the political spectrum. You turn to right-wingers, and they're screaming loudly. You turn to lefties, they're screaming loudly.
Right, right.
You know, people are screaming loudly on cell phones on the street.
Yeah, yeah. And I was having a moment with this young man, Nathaniel Rich, who interviewed me for the Paris Review, and you never know what you say in the moment.
Well, there's some amazing quotes. Another one concerns your early life, which I found interesting. You wanted to be a writer of literary fiction, but that was kind of limited because you pretty much only read crime fiction, and that's what you were drawn to.
Yeah. I have only read genre fiction. My taste in high literature and high art runs to classical music almost exclusively, and I've learned more from listening to Beethoven and the Romantic composers that followed him than I ever have from reading a writer.
You have a great quote. The great theme of film noir is your ...ED.
Yes.
And do you think that that idea permeates all of your work?
No, I don't. I'm optimistic. I'm religious. The ending of The Hilliker Curse is feel good, as is Blood's a Rover. I think the design of the last half or the next 30 years of my career, Act 3, will be to write historical romances. I am not in the least pessimistic or nihilistic.
What do you think at this point, looking back and putting aside that every writer thinks their most recent book is their best? They have to.
Right.
Of all of your other books, which book would you single out? Would it be Dahlia, L.A. Confidential?
Blood's a Rover.
When you look at a book like Dahlia today, do you see it written by you or by somebody else?
A younger man who had not yet realized, and it was in the course of writing that book that I realized, whatever I can conceive, I can execute. Since then, I have been executing on a megalomaniacal scale.
There's another quote about writing, which I find interesting, because I ask a lot of writers this question about the nature of characters, and I found this very illuminating. It's disingenuous when writers say they have no control over their characters. You create characters rigorously and make choices in their behavior. Then you're confronted with dramatic options.
Yes. Well, you write a book, you, Richard Walensky, have created it. The characters do not exist outside your mind and your pen or your keyboard. You may get to a logical juncture, and you have a choice to make, and you take the choice.
Sometimes the choice, though, is dictated by that rigorous character you've created. I mean, if you've got two paths, it becomes pretty self-evident what one of the paths would be. You could push them in the other path, but then you look like a puppet master.
You have created the paths to date. And at some point, whether you act instinctively or not, you are weighing the potential consequences of your dramatic decision.
In writing the outline for, say, Blood's a Rover, right, was there any point where you realized that the characters might push you one way, but the story you wanted to push you another, and you had to kind of, in a sense, go back and reinvent?
Yes, there were times, although the outline for that book is 400 pages long, where I realized I'd written myself into logical gaps and had to go back to clarify.
And do you find that, generally speaking, if you were to compare the writing of a book, and we're talking the outline here, we're not talking the actual sitting down and filling in the gaps, do you sometimes find that what you've done is, in a sense, you're creating kind of a puzzle, and that each step of the way is a question that you need to answer?
Yes, exactly. And the puzzle is first Los Angeles history, then American history. As we move further into my cognizance, your cognizance, 58 to 72, and then the riddle of my own character in my romantic relationships in The Hellacre Curse.
So each step of the way, it is a puzzle in trying to fit those pieces, all of those pieces together.
Yes.
You've got the additional puzzle of you've got your characters and they have to fit within the context logically so that we believe them.
Yes.
How much of that do you think is conscious? I mean, fully conscious.
Everything is fully conscious with me because I have led a very solitary life. Yes, I've been married twice, once briefly, once for 14 years. I have only lived with two women. Eric and I do not live together. I imagine we will marry when her girls go off to college. We can get the hell out of L.A. and go to a cold climate and hunt birds and shovel snow and have pit bulls. But it's consciousness. It's consciousness. I took the trademark staccato style too far in the Cold 6000. I made attempts to redress that flaw in Blood's a Rover. I assumed a new form consciously in The Hellacre Curse. The next novel that I'm going to write, which is about L.A., the month of Pearl Harbor, will be a yet more explicated style.
You're going to continue writing about L.A. then? I mean,
yes.
You're not done with L.A.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
I live there. I am a very healthy 62, and I want to write another quartet, taking characters from the Underworld USA trilogy, American Tao, Blood, Cold 6000, Blood's a Rover, and the first L.A. quartet, Black Dahlia, Big Norley, Confidential, and White Jazz, and as their stated age in the following seven books dictates, place them in L.A. as younger people.
Seven books.
It will be, well, there are seven books extant.
Right.
There will be 11. And my idea is to create a social history that works outward from Los Angeles to America as a whole that returns to Los Angeles.
You call yourself a right-winger.
Uh-huh.
I see literature as political and social. And your books are social commentary. Right-wingers tend to think that books are not, that they're kind of fall in the gaps. And yet your books strike me as not only social commentary, but frequently social commentary that very much a person on the left in a critique would agree with.
I think it comes down, Richard, to personal responsibility. I think it comes down to certain inalterable facts. For instance, Eric and I were in London last year. We were at the bunker where Churchill sat out the Blitz, where he allegedly, toward the end of the war, before two of the great men died, which was Patton and Roosevelt. They were thinking about going and taking Stalin out, which would have been a good deal for the rest of the world. Saved a lot of lives. I live there, and there's a question I pose to people to see if I can get them to address this issue, which you've engaged open-mindedly. which is I've read a lot of political biography, and I tell doctrinaire right-wingers, you cannot read the James McGregor Burns or Joseph P. Lash books of FDR and not dig this guy. Dig him. Let's see. Well, we're talking about FDR. 82% of his social programs tanked. He was willing to exclude blacks and women from the New Deal until Eleanor said, Franklin, you can't do that. It's impossible to read Edmund Morris's book, Dutch, a memoir of Ronald Reagan, and not go, oh, man, that was a man. The man who, more than anyone else, set the bar for Roe v. Wade, who signed the most permissive abortion rights law in American history into effect, was Reagan in June of 1967. None of these guys, if you read history, if you understand the tripartite form of government, see how they're all constrained by governance, you will not be a doctrinaire left-winger or right-winger. You will shift and you will flow and you'll go, okay, I concede. And very few people are willing to concede.
Well, I find it amazing when I mention the fact that the last great liberal president was Richard Nixon. They don't get it.
No, you're utterly right. He floated universal health care at a greater proportion of the budget than Barack Obama.
When you call yourself that, and when I listen to you, you're not going to necessarily be with these strong women who are on the left without a give and take that kind of sets you apart from right or left. That's why I don't quite get your distinction.
Well, it's being obsessed with women, and I have never met a woman worth a S-H in church. And I like the dialogue. I love the struggle. I like the fight.
In the end, it seems like you concede that they win.
There are things that I have taught Erica Schickel she could not have learned from anyone else. There are things that Erica Schickel has taught me that I could have learned from no one else.
Maybe it's just that you're very generous in your book, but it seems to me that there's an openness in you that almost belies some of the individual comments that you've made over the years about yourself.
I think it's that I like to give people and be a bit of a gadfly. And I think if I were to go to a right-wing republic, that I would react accordingly. I'm tired of the whole discourse of left-wing, right-wing, and the people who make money off of it. I want a moratorium. I would like to see no more right-wing talk show hosts and left-wing pundits on late-night TV. I would like everyone to go to their local church, synagogue, or mosque and join an organization that I was privy to as a kid coming from a Protestant background, a wonderfully decorous organization. Dig it. No one talks about this anymore. I don't know if it still exists. The National Council of Christians and Jews.
When you start a book, do you have any particular goal in terms of what you're trying to say, or do you think that just simply emerges?
I got a period of time. I've got the backflow of the previous novel that I have to sustain, or going back to this new series, I've got to figure out Pearl Harbor, I have got to figure out the preceding LAPD scandals of the previous decade that I know virtually nothing about. I thought that the Japanese internment began almost immediately. It wasn't until mid-February. I'm a little bit at sea here, but I'll figure it out. History comes to me first. I am looking at a giant police novel on an unprecedented scale with younger characters before their horrid pathology has been formed from the following seven books. I want to be there then, and all my instincts are leading me there, and I know the forensic science of 1941 very, very well. It was burgeoning ballistics, fingerprints, the occasionally very, very gifted human being who could look at two halves of a bullet and match them up with extreme acuity. I know this stuff, and I want to build a narrative.
Essentially, what you're doing is taking these characters and moving back 10 years in time, essentially, to 10 years earlier.
Yes.
Now, that was at a time when the corruption must have been overwhelming.
LAPD, pre-William Parker, they had a reform mayor. And one of the big questions is, how aware was Fletcher Bowron, who followed the extremely corrupt Shaw brothers, how good a goody-two-shoes was he when he let Clemens Horrell run LAPD? And the Brendallen Vice scandal almost took LAPD down in the late 40s. So I have some briefs to put together. I have some thinking to do. And I want Pearl Harbor to be a character.
Are any of the characters going to be in Hawaii at the time, you think? Or will it
be? All be L.A.
They'll all be L.A. Mickey Cohn, will he play a role?
Let's see. Where was Mickey Cohn? Born in 1913. So 13 from 41 is 28. No, he was in New York.
How about your father?
My father was shacked with my mom.
Not very exciting.
No, unless you were my dad.
Or Rita Hayworth. Or was that later?
That was earlier.
He met Rita in the 30s.
He met Rita in the 30s and was her business manager in the late 1940s. And a lot of this information is ambiguous. I don't know.
Did he ever talk about or accept in sexual terms?
No. It was I and Rita Hayworth. And then I read in a biography of Hayworth 10 years after my father's death that, yes, indeed, he was her business manager in L.A. in the late 40s.
When you're doing this kind of research, where are you going? I mean, obviously.
I hire researchers.
Okay.
And when I have the information about the German-American Bund, fascist groups preceding the Pearl Harbor, Japanese-American life, the hierarchy of the Los Angeles Police Department, forensic science, the preceding decades' police scandals, when I have enough information, I know.
And a book like Tilliker, did you go to Helen and ask her questions about the time frames, or did you kind of just go with your own memory?
I went with my own memory.
How long did it take to write that book?
10 months. Well, I wrote it for Playboy, mea culpa, in a reduced version. I expanded it for the book.
And what's the story of the documentary?
The Playboy Channel filmed me. I have a TV show coming out on the Discovery Channel in the winter called James Ellroy's L.A. City of Demons, where I'm the on-camera star personality host. I do all the interviews. I write the voiceover narration, and I spotlight historical L.A. crimes and more recent L.A. crimes. But the key thing is I have a computer-generated talking police dog named Barco, based on my real-life dog, Barco, who we will see on the other side. And Barco is a corrupt LAPD dog who talks, who rips off drugs at the airport, uses the drugs himself, and then sells the drugs to hophead hounds in South Central Los Angeles.
And this will be on Discovery Channel?
Yes.
What's the name of it again?
James Ellroy's L.A., City of Demons.
And when does it start, you know?
January.
And how much have you done of it so far?
They have committed the 6 episodes. We are shooting the 4th now.
You also talk about doing other writing for film and TV. What have you done?
I wrote a movie called The Night Watchman that was turned into a movie with Keanu Reeves called Street Kings. And as little as can be said about that, the better. Pays my alimony. I have a movie called Rampart about the LAPD's Rampart scandal, which is not at all what you might think.
And what about the American Quartet?
The Underworld USA trilogy is tied up with HBO. They have the first book. Ergo, no one can buy the second two.
Any chance we'll ever see the second in Big Nowhere in film?
I would love to see it, a 3.5-hour movie in black and white. I'm not holding my breath.
In terms of looking back at the film versions, I mean, we could talk all we want about Dahlia.
Right.
You know, was successful for you in terms of getting people to read the book. How do you feel about the film now, and how do you feel about L.A. Confidential now?
L.A. Confidential is a wonderful movie. It's very, very good Elroy Light. It's a much greater reduced storyline, and I'm very pleased with it.
And Dahlia?
There are some movies you want to see. There's some movies you want to flee.
If you were looking at movies that remind you of films that you would have liked to have either written or made, that kind of bring James Ellroy to light, even though they're not by Ellroy, that maybe came ripped out of your head, what would they be? Can you think of any?
There's a 1952 film noir directed by André de Toth, which I recently watched with Erica and her esteemed film critic dad, Richard Schickel, called Crime Wave. It's all shot in L.A. locations. It's Sterling Hayden, and he is the Hammett prototype character, possessed of an odd humanity, steals every scene he is, imperiously large and tall, smarter than everyone else, plays off every faction against each other, and you're not quite sure of his motives.
And the name of the movie again?
Crime Wave.
Crime Wave.
I do the audio commentary with Eddie Muller.
James Ellroy, we've seen The Hilliker Curse now. How long before we see the first of these other books?
Two more years.
Two more years.
Yes. 10.5 months of outlining, 9 months of writing.
You've been listening to an interview with James Ellroy, whose latest book is The Hilliker Curse, a memoir. And Bloods Are Over is now out in trade paperback.
Yes.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.